smaller the committee, the more important the members. Good afternoon. It is 1:40 in the afternoon of Wednesday, February 29th, Leap Day. Happy Leap Day, everybody.
That's right.
And this will be the only meeting for a long time on Leap Day, so we just want to take a little moment to celebrate that. We have Senator McGuire here, Vice Chair Senator Wilikowski, myself, Senator French. We've got two bills up today dealing with the same topic. Each takes a pretty significant different approach to the issue, and we're going to begin with the committee members' bill, SB 212. Senator McGuire, take it away.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, and happy birthday to those people that only get to celebrate once every 4 years, huh? So today I am putting forward a bill on a topic that is near and dear to everyone here in this committee. Senate Bill 212 would establish a task force on the issue of sex trafficking. This session, legislation is being brought to the table by the governor, whose bill we'll hear next, by Senator Wilikowski in Senate Bill 110, which we recently heard in committee. We've also had our U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski speaking as recent as last summer in the U.S. Committee on Indian Affairs regarding sex trafficking, domestic violence, and sexual assault among our Alaska Native and American Indian population. The mayor of our city, Senator Wilikowski, Senator French in my city, Mayor Sullivan recently declared January 12th as a day of human trafficking awareness, unprecedented, to try and get the attention in our local community about this plight. My office has spoken with national and local community organizations and nonprofits. I know your offices have as well, Mr. Chairman. In particular, Sergeant Kathy Lacey of the APD Special Victims Unit has been very helpful to our office. We know that there's a disconnect between the federal and state laws. We know that we need to do a lot more from the state level to provide services to victims of this terrible tragedy and to find ways to reach out and provide education to prevent this epidemic, make more people aware of what's happening. We know in particular that young women are being targeted, specifically those that are vulnerable from having moved in to urban areas from rural communities where they lack support of their family and community. The national statistics hold true in Anchorage that 1 in 3 women on the street are drawn into prostitution within 48 hours. And in particular, I want to thank also the Covenant House group and their support. They have confidential meetings with a lot of the young women and men that on an intake basis, and they have gone out of their way to reveal the outcome of some of those confidential meetings just as a general proposition. And we have a lot of young women that are coming into Covenant House as victims of these sex trafficking rings. And so I want to thank them for their input as well. This task force would be established under the Department of Law. The Attorney General or the Attorney General's designee would serve as the chair of the task force. It would also consist of representatives from the Department of Law, Department of Public Safety, and Health and Social Services. Under this bill, 212, we would be receiving a report to the legislature January 15th of 2013, so this next year. Specifically, we've asked in the legislation, and I am open to any other suggestions that this committee has, but these were the things I thought the legislature would want to have at a minimum. We'd like to know the number of human trafficking cases reported to the state and local law enforcement agencies since 2007. We also would like to know the number of human trafficking cases prosecuted under Alaska law. We want to know the number of human trafficking cases and local law enforcement the number of human trafficking cases state and local law enforcement agencies have investigated in cooperation with federal law enforcement agencies. We know that there are a lot of these federal to state conversations where it intersects, and we want to know more about it so that we can find a way to fill in the gaps. We also want to know about the services that are currently available in the state to victims of human trafficking, including the services that might be provided by the state, the federal agencies, or non-governmental agencies like Covenant House. Those that relate to medical or psychological counseling, emergency shelter, translation services for those that do not have English as a first language, or other assistance related to safe housing and legal services. With this information, it's my belief that we can start to help the victims of our state even better than we have in the past. We want to look at the numbers and have those difficult conversations about the laws that we have on the books and resources that we have available so that we can begin to help. I'm passionate about finding a place for a civil remedy as well, and I've discussed this with you, Mr. Chairman, and others, both to aid victims and to deter criminals that might have a financial incentive to run these sex trafficking rings. This task force would give a better understanding of the current services available and provide information to us as a legislative body. It's my hope that they'll reflect on the possibility of that civil remedy as well, whether it makes sense as an additional deterrent to the criminal penalties that we have. And so with that, I'd be happy to take any questions or suggestions about the bill.
Thank you, Senator McGuire. I'll start off. I think it's a really good idea. I like the approach. As I was sitting here listening to you describe the bill, I thought about the some of the debate we had when Senator Wilikowski's bill was in front of us, and not to say confusion, but just some of the wrestling with the aspects of trafficking that are hard to get your hands around, and so I think this is a good a way to approach the idea. Let's stop and welcome Senator Pascman to the committee. Senator Pascman, we're on Senate Bill 212, Senator McGuire's a bill that would establish a human trafficking task force.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Welcome. And so I'll be thinking, as we talk about the bill some more, about the intersection between trafficking and prostitution. The governor's bill that we have up next makes some legal redefinitions from one area to another. And so I'll be thinking about, whether the task force should also be looking at prostitution cases and seeing whether how many prostitution cases have an aspect of trafficking and how many don't, because I think, there's a lot of what we just consider to be sort of normal prostitution cases, whatever that is, but then there's a lot where we feel like a woman's been exploited, brought into Anchorage or seduced or whatever the right word is, sort of drawn into the world having just moved to Anchorage, and that touched on the idea that Senator Wilikowski was trying to get at. So I think it's a good approach because we're all sort of grappling with what to do about this, and sometimes you get enough smart people in a room and get them thinking for a couple times, and some really good things pop out. Let's stop and welcome Senator Coghill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Other questions from members of the committee for Senator McGuire? Senator Coghill, we just got an overview of Senate Bill 212, Senator McGuire's bill on a task force about human trafficking. We do have one person signed up to testify. Let's turn and get James Dold. I hope I'm saying your name right, sir, or D-O-L-D, who's coming to us live from Washington, D.C. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, and we very much appreciate the opportunity to come and testify via phone before the Judiciary Committee. And first, let me start off by thanking both Senator Wilikowski and Senator McGuire. I've been in touch with both of their staff previously on this issue, and we're really excited to see Senator McGuire introduce this bill. My name is James Dolan, and I serve as policy counsel for Polaris Project. Polaris Project is an anti-human trafficking organization based out of Washington, D.C. We've been around for about 10 years now, and we do three primary things in this area. We directly serve people who have been victimized or who are survivors of both labor and sex trafficking in the Washington, D.C., Virginia, Maryland, New York, New Jersey, and Japan areas. To date, we've served over 500 survivors of human trafficking, offering them holistic case management and treatment, including group therapy sessions. We have a transitional housing program and helping victims really get acclimated and be ready to re-enter into a normalized life after they've been rescued from either a labor or sex trafficking situation. We also operate the National Human Trafficking Resource Center and the National Hotline for the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. To date, we've fielded over 48,000 calls from across the country referencing both labor and sex trafficking situations. So basically, and we've also received some of those calls from Alaska, although they are smaller in number compared to some more of our size, larger states population-wise. We have a network referral base of about 3,500 strong, so that includes service providers, law enforcement, both local and state, that we can field tips out to. Since we started operating the hotline, we have sent over 2,000 tips to law enforcement agencies across the country, and have identified over 5,200 potential victims of human trafficking. And then the last area that Polaris Project operates is we engage in policy advocacy at both the state and federal level, working closely with law enforcement, prosecutors, service providers to build out strong legal frameworks in which communities can more adequately respond to human trafficking. And I thought I might start my testimony out just by opening up and giving a little bit of an overview of trafficking. I was on the last call when SB 110 came up. Unfortunately, I was actually cut off right before I came onto the line, and I think the committee had moved on to something else. But let me just first start off by giving a broad definition of what human trafficking is, how it's recognized under both international law and U.S. law, both federal and both state law, and then dive into that and how that pertains to Alaska. Under the federal definition of trafficking, I think the best way to probably look at it is that you've got two types of activities that are occurring. You have those individuals who are using force, threats, other coercive tactics to actually compel or induce somebody to engage in a commercial sex act or a forced labor or services. Then you have sort of the other folks who are sort of the facilitators of trafficking, if you will. Those people who are recruiting, enticing, soliciting, harboring, or transporting individuals, knowing that once they get to the destination point that they're going to be in a forced labor or services or commercial sexual exploitation type of situation. Now, the only distinction there is when you have a child who's under the age of 18. All children under the age of 18 who are engaged in commercial sex, regardless of whether you have a third-party controller, are viewed as victims under federal law, and they would be deemed to be victims of trafficking and a victim of a severe form of trafficking. So the mere fact that somebody, a child, has been induced to engage in a commercial sex act, say by a John who's out soliciting them, would make that child a victim of commercial sexual exploitation under most federal and state laws. Now, I think the thing that's important to keep in mind here as well is sort of the trauma that we're talking about when it comes to these victims. Victims oftentimes, especially both foreign national victims and U.S. citizen victims, are exposed to severe amounts of trauma, and including, you know, all different types of force, beatings, rape, threats of violence against one's family, threats of violence against that person. Sometimes you have the control and manipulation of immigration documents that also help to restrict the movement of these individuals if they're foreign national victims. For children, especially for younger children, some of the telltale signs that we look for are whether or not those children have ID or whether they know where they're at any given time. Oftentimes, traffickers like to keep their victims sort of in the dark about where they're at. And one of the big problems, especially for children who have been exploited through sex trafficking, is that oftentimes you'll see a emotional bond that's formed. A lot of times these kids are coming from broken homes, they're runaway and homeless youth, very vulnerable populations, and they come across a pimp who offers them a new life, you know, a better way of life, and for a kid who's never known that, that's a very alluring attraction for them. And what happens is they get involved in a very terrible situation. Oftentimes they'll, you know, fall in love. That's not uncommon to see many of the victims of sex trafficking, especially the children, not even identify themselves as victims and not even their pimps or traffickers as their victimizers, but rather identify those individuals as their boyfriend or their caretaker. And so for those children, it can be especially difficult to remove them from those situations because of that brainwashing that's occurred and that emotional bond that has formed, which has made getting at that particular group who's been victimized particularly difficult. And what we've seen in some states are the advent of what are called safe harbor laws that create a new system in which children are actually viewed as victims of a crime rather than prostitutes, and so they wouldn't be subject to arrest and would rather be diverted to CPS and the Department of Children and Families and whatnot. Oftentimes with labor trafficking situations, I'd say that we see a predominance of foreign national victims, but I think there's a lot of overlap as well, especially if you have somebody who is in an intimate partner situation. Sometimes we see it come up with arranged marriages or people who come over from other countries who are then forced to work all hours of the day, either by the person they've married or by other members of that family. It's not uncommon also to see individuals who are domestic servants in other capacities, both foreign nationals as well as U.S. citizen children. I think one of the big trends that we see on the national hotline with regards to children are something called traveling sales crews, where individuals are trafficked from state to state and go door to door selling different types of things, such as magazines and whatnot. So there's a lot of different types of labor and sex trafficking networks that are operating across the country. And one of the things to keep in mind, especially with domestic pimp control prostitution, is that even though you'll have pimps that are operating individually, they'll also be part of a more coordinated unit. So you'll have pimps who are talking with one another and letting each other know where enforcement efforts are up. And that's why you see oftentimes pimps will travel from state to state with their what's known as their stable of girls. And, you know, they'll go from place to place getting information from other pimps about what's going on in different locations where they're seeking to travel. The other thing that I'd mention on this front is that there's a very complicated network of rules and regulations that are sort of in place to keep the girls and the women from escaping those situations and sort of to keep them in the trafficking situation, in essence. And what you see oftentimes is domestic pimps working together in terms of enforcing these rules. So, for instance, just to give a couple of examples, there are rules such as, you know, the women that are on the streets can't look at another pimp in the eye. You know, and if they break those rules, their money can get taken from them. Or when a woman is walking on the street, you know, she's not allowed to actually walk on the street. When another pimp is on the sidewalk, she's forced to work in the gutter. And if a woman or a girl breaks those rules, pimps will engage in what is known as a pimp circle and circle around the woman, you know, shouting different mean and horrible things to her. And that's sort of another method of control and a punishment, if you will, for breaking the rules of the game. And so these sex trafficking networks, and these are just a couple of brief examples just to give the committee an overview of what we're dealing with here. These sex trafficking networks are very, they can be, you know, very individualized in the sense of you have one pimp, but you can also have networks of individuals working and collaborating together, especially when you get to the more organized criminal aspect of it, such as what we commonly refer to as Asian massage parlors. We have commercial front businesses operating as illicit brothels where they bring in women typically from Southeast Asia, from Thailand, China, South Korea to work in these places. It's by no means, illicit massage parlors are by no means limited to just the Southeast Eastern culture. You also have other types of demographics that are also affected and that are brought into the United States specifically for sex trafficking purposes. We also see a lot of sex trafficking cases and labor trafficking cases happening in strip clubs as well, where both U.S. citizens and foreign nationals are, you know, sometimes they're duped into thinking that they're going to have another job if they're overseas. There was a big famous case out of Chicago where Ukrainian sex trafficking ring had brought girls over promising that they were going to dance ballet, but when in fact they got here, they were forced to work at a strip club. Same thing happens with domestic pimp control prostitution. I think one of the things that we're beginning to see more and more of is pimps requiring the women to go into strip clubs and work to solicit for johns as patrons in those clubs, as well as just to make additional money during the day. So you have those women essentially working, you know, almost 24 hours a day. And so that is just a little bit of an overview of some of the things that we're trying to get at. And, you know, and I know that the governor's bill is up, so maybe I can hold my comments for those because there's a lot of substantive comments that I'll have when that bill comes up. But let me just say with regards to Senator McGuire's bill, I think it's a really great one. I've seen this approach taken in a lot of states where, you know, states are just coming up and getting more acquainted with the issue of human trafficking. And so what is often done is a human trafficking task force or an advisory committee is established. I actually sit on an advisory committee up in the state of Pennsylvania right now, helping them draft their law. And, you know, and to have it in the Department of Law, I think, is the best place to have it. The Attorney General's office is, as the chief law enforcement officer and a chief prosecutor in the land, certainly the best place. The one thing I would say is that it might also be helpful, I think, you know, in terms of where the task force consists of representatives of the Department of Law, Department of Public Safety, and Department of Health and Social Services. It might also be helpful to expand that to different NGOs and service providers like Covenant House, like Senator McGuire mentioned before, that are directly working on this. what we've seen as an effective mechanism across the country is when law enforcement and HHS service providers work collaboratively with the NGOs and the service providers that are operating in the field and that have had a lot of experience for quite some time, especially places like Covenant House, who we work quite closely with, not necessarily in Alaska, but in other places of the country. And so, so I certainly, you know, encourage the committee to expand it to include other NGOs that are based in Alaska. The other thing that I'd say is that you might also want to consider other things that the task force could look at, such as coming up with legislative recommendations, possibly, to report back to the legislature whatever their findings were. I sat on a task force up in Vermont a couple of years ago where the Attorney General's office was tasked with chairing the task force, and one of the chief duties was to come up with a list of legislative recommendations that were ultimately passed into law back in, I think it was 2011 now. So, I mean, I think there's a lot of interesting things that, you know, that can be done with these task forces, but I think that Senator McGuire's bill certainly has the right idea, and I think this is definitely a much-needed first step to begin addressing the overall needs of victims of human trafficking in Alaska, especially the service needs that a lot of these victims are going to need. And it's also a great first step to get the right people at the table. Oftentimes, what I see in states is where you have these types of bills and you get folks from the AG's office, you get folks from the Department of Health, from the Department of Human Services, all at the table where they might not have, you know, come together before talking about this one specific issue. And so I think that is a, you know, that's a great component of this bill. The other thing is, you know,
Mr. Dole,
I'm sorry, am I going over a little bit?
That's okay. I wonder if I can just get you to summarize, please.
Yeah, and so with that, you know, we're definitely in support of Senator McGuire's bill. We're happy that it's been introduced, and we would urge the committee to act favorably upon it.
Fantastic. Let me see if there's any questions. Senator Coghill has a question.
Mr. Chair, in danger of stretching us out, the testifier is a part of what group?
I'm sorry. Mr. Dold is from the Polaris Project. It's a nationwide advocacy.
Okay. And that's what I thought that was true. The question is the Polaris group, and I know there are other groups that are peers to yours are doing some of this work. Can you give me some kind of an idea of who you work kind of horizontally with in this area?
Yeah, nationally, so there's a national working group called the Alliance to End Slavery and Trafficking, which is a group comprised of Polaris Project, the International Justice Mission, the CAST, which is the Coalition Against Slavery and Trafficking, Vital Voices, and there's about 10 or 15 other organizations in this area that we work closely with. We also work very closely with an organization called Shared Hope International, which is a domestic minor sex trafficking organization that focuses exclusively on the sex trafficking of minors, and we work quite closely with them on state legislative efforts across the country as well.
Mr. Chairman,
go ahead.
I'm sorry. I thought you were done. Sorry. Keep going.
Oh yeah, and then when we go into individual states, we try and work as closely as possible with the domestic violence and sexual violence coalitions in each of those individual states.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And the reason I ask that is, you know, looking at a task force, there are people that have run very, very deep in this as far as things that they recommend. And I'll give you an example. He was talking about Shared Hope International. I've been a supporter of Shared Hope International for a few years. And they are international, obviously, but they have looked at laws, and just like this group with the Polaris Project, they have expertise that may be able to be delivered in almost package form before we actually start down the road of task force work on how that works in Alaska. Just like his testimony, even though it was short, you can see there's just information that goes way deep that might be worth looking at preliminary to instituting this or including that in the institution of this. So just a thought.
Good comments. Senator Pascrane has a question.
Yes, one of the questions that I was going to ask in your analysis of other states or other jurisdictions, and I assume that there are task force in other jurisdictions, and is one of the points that is looked into is the demographics of you know, for example, Alaska-specific predictors? In other words, do they do it in California? You know, are there California-specific predictors? Are there West Coast-specific predictors? And it seems like what we've been hearing in Alaska is that there may be Alaska-specific predictors of where trafficking would arise. Is that something that would be appropriate for a task force to look into?
Absolutely. I think that Alaska, especially Alaska, because it is a very, I mean, each state is different. And certainly, you know, we see the different types of trafficking networks take hold in different types of places. And certainly because of the vulnerable population of natives in Alaska, and just from what I'm hearing from folks that are serving on the federal task force up there and people like Sergeant Kathy Lacey, that is a huge issue in certain types of industries, specifically for labor trafficking. So that's certainly something that we definitely, I think that's a great idea to look into specifically what types of industries could potentially be most affected for labor trafficking as it pertains to Alaska. Absolutely.
Good comments. Thank you, Mr. Dole. I don't see any other comments. Let me see if there's anyone else in the room who wants to testify about SB 212. Don't see any. Then we will go ahead and close public testimony. We'll have invited testimony afterwards on this bill. Any other closing comments from you, Senator McGuire, before we turn to the next bill?
No, I'd like to thank James Nolan for his advocacy and suggestions. Appreciate all of his time. And other than that,
thank you very much. Great comments. Good presentation. Let's turn to a related bill. That's SB 218. It's a governor's bill. It's been introduced by the Rules Committee at the request of the governor. And we should have a member of the Department of Law who's coming forward, Andy Carpinetti, to give us an overview of this bill. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you very much for hearing this bill today. We appreciate it. Let's see. SB 218 deals with sex trafficking and several other sex offenses. And first of all, I'd just like to say the first reason that we decided to, that we were drafting this bill arose really in this committee room last year when we heard police law enforcement officers like Kathy Lacey and various other really competent people, witnesses and legislators, talk about sex trafficking. And it finally dawned on me that what they were talking about is what our statutes generally refer to as promotion of prostitution. That is a person victimizing another person and inducing her, usually her, to engage in prostitution. So the bill changes the name, at least, of our promoting prostitutions to sex trafficking so that when we're talking about these offenses, we're all talking about the same thing. I think it will help. I mean, it does change those words, but I think it will help so that when we're speaking about what these offenses are, we're speaking about the same thing. And there's a really good policy reason to do that, too, as Mr. Dole alluded to. The people who are trafficked, especially children, should be referred to as victims rather than as prostitutes. And although it's really hard to totally rewrite these statutes, to the extent we can, we should write them in a way that would allow us to refer to the people who are trafficked as victims rather than as prostitutes. So last night I was counting up the pages in this bill. I know it's an 18-page bill, but over 12 of them are pages that change the name of the promoting prostitution statutes to sex trafficking and also conform the other statutes in our laws that refer to that crime. So I will try in the rest of my presentation to use the word sex trafficking, but I don't know, I have a lot of years talking about promoting prostitution, but I'll try my best to do that. So the bill does other things, and I'd like to describe in more detail what it does in terms of other crimes. Section 3 of the bill adds the two crimes, sex trafficking in the first degree and human trafficking in the first degree, to those to our conspiracy law. So what it does is adds those crimes to the definition of serious felony in our conspiracy law. law, which will allow us to prosecute people who work together to commit these crimes and not necessarily individually commit the target crime. The penalty for conspiracy to commit this crime is one level below the crime itself, so that sex trafficking in the first degree of a child under 18 is currently an unclassified felony in our law. So conspiracy to commit sex trafficking in the first degree if the victim is under 18 years of age would be a Class A felony under the changes in the bill.
And I take it to be a B felony if the person was not under 18?
Yes, okay. It would be a Class B felony. And then for human trafficking in the first degree, that's a Class A felony. If a person was convicted of conspiracy to commit human trafficking in the first degree, that would be a Class B felony.
And is there no age differentiation in human trafficking?
No, there is not.
Thank you.
Section 4 of the bill amends our crime prohibiting distribution of indecent materials to minors. And this change is in response to the decision by a federal district court last summer that the statute in our laws is unconstitutionally overbroad because he found that it could apply to protected conduct between adults. So it changes the provisions in that statute by, one, requiring the state to prove that the defendant intentionally distributed or possessed with intent to distribute prohibited material to a child that the person, the defendant, knows is under 16 years of age or believes is under 16 years of age. And it also would require the state to prove that the defendant knew that the material depicted the prohibited conduct in the statute. With these three changes, we hope that we have answered the concerns of the court in finding them the statute to be overbroad.
Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, maybe I'm misreading this, but if someone is 30 years old and they intentionally give one of these, they intentionally distribute material to someone who is 25 years old, but they believe that they're under 15, they just person looks really young, that person is committing the crime then?
If they believe the person to be under 16. And the reason for that is to allow investigators to find perpetrators not in a face-to-face context, but in a internet context.
That's like a sting kind of thing. Okay.
Well, yes, that's how okay. Investigators find these people. So we're hoping that, and we think we're pretty confident that those should answer the judge's concerns.
We all passed the statute. It always irritates me to have a statute struck down as unconstitutional, but it happens, and I'm glad the Department of Law is stepping forward with a fix.
The next changes to our current law is in Sections 5 and 6 of the bill, which raise the penalty for a patron of a prostitute who is under 18 years old from a Class B misdemeanor to a Class C felony. And it also specifically provides that the age of the prostitute is a circumstance that does not require proof of a culpable mental state. The legislature can do that under our law if the legislature makes it clear that that it is making a particular circumstance one that the state does not have to prove a culpable mental state in regard to. You may remember it was in 2007, and I think this committee put together House Bill 90, which included portions of Senator Dyson's bill, Senate Bill 157. And this bill was the first statute ever passed since, I think it's since statehood, that made it a crime to be a patron of a prostitute. Up until that time, it was not a crime for the patron of a prostitute to engage in that conduct. This raises the penalty when the prostitute is under 18 years old.
And we'll probably do some thinking about this. Given the states, are you concerned at all with the fact that the age of consent in Alaska is 16?
In a sense, I think it's defensible because a person, the sex trafficking statutes deal with children under 18, with minors under 18.
Right.
So I think, that is certainly something that will be litigated, but I think we I think we're pretty confident that we can do that.
So let me make sure I understand. Is this aimed at the patron or at the prostitute?
It's
the
aimed only at the patron. And it's the increased penalty is aimed only at the patron.
Right.
And
now, let's stop and let's just remind ourselves that if it turns out that the prostitute is 15, the suspect or the defendant or whoever, the John, is now committed sex abuse of a minor of some degree.
Yes.
Right? So there's that. The reason I'm talking about this is because I heard a speech earlier today by a very wise man, sort of cautioning us about sort of driving more nonviolent people into prison. That's what I took away. And so, I'll be looking at this. I'm very sensitive to the argument that the position the Department of Law is taking, but I'm also trying to not make everything a felony, to come up with a shorthand phrase. So,
well, that criticism is well taken. I will also say that.
More as an observation than a criticism, but sure.
Well, I will also say that Quinlan Steiner, the public defender, has made a suggestion in terms of drafting this particular provision to make it even more clear that the heightened penalty applies only to the patron, not to the prostitute. I think his criticism is well taken, and it would something that should be inserted in the bill.
We'll look forward to seeing a suggestion from you about that language.
Okay. Section 12 of the bill just amends the corroboration provision for sex trafficking by providing that in 1978, when the criminal code was written, the legislature adopted the provision that specifically said that there is no corroboration necessary of the prostitute's testimony in the prosecution of a sex trafficking case. But in 2007, when the legislature addressed prostitution and promoting prostitution statutes, they didn't change the corroboration to apply to the new crime of fourth degree promoting prostitution or sex trafficking. So this does that. I think that was an oversight at that time. Section 13 provides for forfeiture of property gained or used in promoting prostitution or sex trafficking, and it also applies to prostitution itself.
A question I'll have on this, and it may have to be something we send back to the municipality of Anchorage, but how many cars, aren't they seizing cars? Are they seizing the cars of John's now in Anchorage?
I would defer to Sergeant Lacey to answer that question, but I can find out.
This is an inquiry. We'll find out, yep.
Section 16 of the bill lets us step away for a moment from sex crimes and sex trafficking to competency hearings. And Section 16 allows a court in his or her discretion to allow the testimony of a witness at a competency hearing to testify by contemporaneous two-way video teleconferencing. Just for a little background, a person can't be tried for a crime if, as a result of mental disease or defect, he or she is unable to understand the nature of the charges against him or the nature of the proceedings, or assist his or her attorney in their defense. Competency proceedings are always before trial. They involve the testimony of usually expert witnesses on either side of the case, testifying as to the results of his or her examination of the defendant. It's unlike the criminal trial itself, in the sense that the full panoply of constitutional rights really don't apply in this setting. First of all, if the defendant is the one who's claiming to be incompetent, it's a burden on him or her to prove by a preponderance of the evidence that he or she is not competent. Generally, most of those burdens are on the prosecution to disprove. And there have been several federal cases that have recognized that certain constitutional guarantees, in this case it would be the Sixth Amendment guarantee of confrontation, do not necessarily apply in this context. So this allows, in certain circumstances, for the court to agree to have usually an expert, a psychiatrist or a psychologist, testify by contemporaneous two-way video teleconferencing.
And what are the rules now? If one side objects, that objecting party can essentially force an in-court discussion of all of this?
Generally, yes.
Okay. And I'm sure we'll hear from other folks about the possible legal challenges we'll meet to this.
Yes,
does any other state have this?
I'm sure they do. I will get you a list of the states that do. It has been, I mean, they have been approved by the Supreme Court in certain contexts, okay. Or by, like, the Ninth Circuit approved a similar proceeding where the constitutional, the same trial constitutional rights, rights of Fifth Amendment. So it has been approved, and I will get you the authority for that.
Thank you.
It is a little edgy, mm-hmm. I would say, you know, because of the right of confrontation. But the value, I mean, as long as it's two-way contemporaneous video conferencing, it's pretty close to in-court testimony, and it saves these expert witnesses a lot of effort to fly to a remote area and testify in a case.
Sure. Senator Passman.
Is there an implied requirement that the professional be licensed in Alaska as compared to, you know, this is a witness testifying from California, Washington, D.C., who knows where?
Through the chair, no. I'm sure that there are experts in our that testify as to the competency of witnesses and to other issues, too, that are from other states, and sometimes they testify by telephone. I mean, there's a lot of cases of telephonic testimony, but usually the people have to consent, both sides have to consent to having it done that way. Section 20 of the bill amends sex offender registration. This has been in a governor's bill before, and I know that there is some disagreement by some members of this committee, but it would require a sex offender from another state who moves to this state to register in our state, regardless of whether the crime he or she is registered for is similar to a crime in our state. The Department of Public Safety gets several calls every month from people who are interested in finding out whether if they moved here they would have to register as a sex offender. And it just seems for the safety of the people in our state, it makes sense to require them to register here if they are required to register where they're coming from.
I'll have to reactivate that whole debate stream, but
yeah.
I remember it's been the subject of vigorous debate.
Thank right. You. And lastly, there's only one more section in the bill, and that is Section 25, which is similar in competency hearing evidence, but it would adopt a new court rule that would allow in trial situations the court to order contemporaneous two-way video teleconferencing of the testimony of a witness in very limited circumstances. These would be case-specific circumstances. It has been approved by the United States Supreme Court in Maryland versus Craig.
What's the second name?
Maryland versus Craig. And
Greg
Maryland versus Craig, C-R-A-I-G.
Oh, yeah, thank you. Okay.
And I have a copy of that decision here. Well, maybe I don't have it here, but I can provide it for you. That upheld it over Justice Scalia's dissent that approved this kind of testimony, two-way video teleconferencing testimony, in very limited fact-specific circumstances. And the rule that we are proposing for your consideration is that the court must find that the witness is, in fact, unavailable, either out of the country, ill, other various scenarios. One case, Giganti, where the Supreme Court denied certification review, approved it in a case where the witness was essentially dying. It was a mob, a mob prosecution, and this witness was in the witness protection program. He was in the hospital dying. He did not have the physical ability to get to court, so they did this two-way contemporaneous video testimony for his testimony. The witness must be – oh, sorry.
No, how many courtrooms have this capacity at this time?
Well, I think several of our courtrooms have the capacity. What you would have to do is to have the video conference played in the courtroom. What you would need to do is have the facility to go to where the witness is and have that witness testify in Scotland or wherever he or she is outside. One of the definitions of unavailability here is they're outside the reach of our courts process. So it has happened under a number of circumstances where, you know, parents of a child victim are simply unwilling to bring their child back to testify in a case. And, you know, the prosecution simply can't go forward without that evidence. And finally, the state would have to prove that the use of the testimony is necessary to further an important public policy. It's up to the judge's discretion. The fact-finding has to be by clear and convincing evidence. But in those few, we imagine the situations to be pretty rare, but in those prosecutions where you really need the testimony of a critical witness to proceed in order to have a prosecution, and the judge finds that it is important enough to suspend in a way, just a minor way, the right to confront and cross the face-to-face. I mean, there's the circumstances would allow cross-examination, contemporaneous cross-examination, but it wouldn't be face-to-face. And that's what this proposed rule would allow in fact-specific circumstances where there's an important public policy for doing so. And if there are any questions, I'll try and answer them.
Is this done now by consent, by the consent of both sides?
Right now, yes. If both sides would consent, yes. This rule allows the court to order it when both sides do not consent.
Do not consent, right. Yes. And I thought I saw something in here about 50 miles. What's the 50 mile?
Oh, that applies to the contemporaneous testimony in competency hearings.
Oh, okay.
So it's different from...
So there's no 50-mile rule to this side?
No, this is different. This is in trial, so
right.
It's more limited because of the constitutional protections for a person being tried for a criminal charge are not at all diminished in the situations that the rule addresses, the proposed rule.
And by contemporaneous... you mean that this can't have been pre-recorded, even though there might have been full confrontation and full cross-examination. It can't be pre-recorded and played to a jury. It's got to happen live in front of a jury.
Right, as if the person were in the courtroom.
Right. Yeah.
So it's, you know, I was thinking about how it worked with the child witness provision in that was passed in 1994, I think, that allows closed circuit television of a child witness that is unable to.
Might have been, was it 94 or 04? Because I know I did a provision for child witnesses.
I think maybe it was amended in 04.
Okay.
But that procedure does not require the witness to face the defendant.
Right.
This requires the witness to
right.
to testify under circumstances as if he or she were in the courtroom. But is not because they're in a hospital bed or they're out of the country or they're in a position where we can't get process on them. We can't get them here.
Interesting cutting-edge idea. Senator Wolakowski.
Yeah. Do other states do this, the taking of video conference?
Well, they're starting to. I mean, it's not a common practice to my knowledge, but we have had... circuit courts and the Supreme Court approve of it, so it is happening. In Maryland, it happened. It was approved in the situation in Maryland. It has been approved by other federal district courts in other circuits. So other states are starting to do it. It makes a lot of sense with our technology.
Is there a way that you can ensure that someone doesn't have documents there that they're looking at, or that someone isn't standing off to the side holding, you know, writing answers and passing them to the witness? Or?
Well, the proposed rule in the bill provides that either party could request the court to exclude anybody else from the presence of the witness except for the video video operator. So, yes, there is a way.
And is this like a licensed video operator, or can I stand there with my video camera and videotape the witness myself?
Through the chair, that's a good question. I'd have to find out about that. I don't know the answer to that. I don't know that we have a licensed procedure for video recorders, but I'm sure that a party could request a particular person, or, you know, request that that person at least come in front of the court and be questioned about their, you know, so that we could ensure that they would be.
As a member of the Commission on Post-Secondary Education, I'm going to guess that the Alaska Career Academy is just now thinking maybe we ought to have a video conference commission certificate.
There are requirements in the civil rules if you're going to take a video deposition as far as announcing, you know, certain requirements under the civil rules.
I see, to set the foundation,
yes.
So to speak.
Yeah, just okay. Who they are and all those types of things. You have to identify that in the civil rules.
Yeah. So, Mr. Chairman,
Senator Coghill.
It would be my expectation that under this that both council, sets of councils have to agree to it, so there would be a natural tension on that or not?
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, no. Mm-hmm. I mean, right now, both parties could agree to it. Mm-hmm. This allows the court, under certain limited circumstances, to allow this sort of testimony, even if one party does not agree.
So then my expectation is the court is the facilitator of this?
Well, the court would make the decision, and then the proposed rule, and of course it's probably going to be changed. I mean, you could make any amendments you wanted to, but it allows the trial court to set up the procedure in each particular case, and they will differ depending on the age of the witness and the circumstances in which the witness finds him or herself. You might want a parent to be with the person, or if it's a child, or you might need a translator. It just depends on the circumstances.
Okay. And that gets us to the end of the bill here, but did we discuss all the sections, or are you going to go back through and do we touch on Section 1, for example?
Section 1 is one of those sections that simply conforms.
I see. Just changes
statute.
Over. The ones, I see, yep.
So I didn't specifically.
There's no point in, yep.
Discuss them. Actually, there is one section that I think I ought to bring to your attention that has one additional provision in it, and that's Section 19. It's on page 12 of the bill, and it conforms the change to sex trafficking from promoting prostitution, and then it corrects an omission in a statute that was passed last year that raised or that put online enticement of a minor into that category of sex offenses in 1255 125 for heightened penalties for serious sex offenders. And it did not go back and add that particular crime to the definition of most serious felony in the definitional sections of 1255. So that's an addition that I consider to be pretty minor, but it is not conforming to the sex trafficking change.
Thank you. We do have some folks online, both to answer questions, and we have two folks here who have signed up to testify. Let's turn, if we could, to Kathy Monfreda, who's on the line. And Ms. Monfreda is a employee of the Department of Public Safety. And I understand she can give us some examples of the sorts of of the offenses for which you have to register out of Alaska, but not in Alaska. That is offenses that would fall under this this new proposal in the bill. Ms. Monfreda, are you there?
Yes, sir, I am.
And welcome to the committee. Go ahead and put yourself on the record and tell us a little bit more about Section 20 if you have a copy of the bill in front of you.
Yes, sir. My name is Kathy Monfreda. I am Chief of the Criminal Records and Identification Bureau for the Department of Public Safety, and my duties include management of the Sex Offender Registry.
Tell me, if you could, the section I have in front of me says that you would have to register, or it'd be a crime not to register, if you had committed a crime in another jurisdiction that requires you to register as a sex offender or a child kidnapper in that jurisdition. And those would be, and the real issue is what crimes might those be that our statutes don't cover or for which there's some substantial difference?
Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman. A couple of examples would be Washington has a law about communicating with a minor for immoral purposes. They also have a crime called assault with sexual motivation. The elements don't meet our requirement to register as a sex offender up here. some of the U.S. Code of Military Justice offenses don't qualify, don't have the elements that are similar to what requires them to register up here.
Thank you. It's been represented that you get inquiries on a monthly basis about the, whether an individual would have to register here in Alaska for crimes committed outside. Does that comport with your experience?
Yes, sir. We've been tracking those calls since last year's legislative session, and we get on the average about 3 or 4 a month.
And how many of those are inquiries regarding crimes for which we do not have an analog? Is that, am I clear that that's what we're talking about?
Yes, sir. For the most part, they're calling and trying to tell us their story and have us tell them immediately if they'd have to register or not. Quite often it takes a lot of research to make that determination. So we won't make the determination immediately for them, but they do call and ask.
And if we passed this bill, you'd always say yes.
Exactly.
Senator Wilkowski.
If somebody moved from one state to another state where they had a lesser penalty, I'm just wondering if it's a possibility of sort of laundering your conviction. If you moved from, say, New Jersey to New York, and then from New York, New Jersey had to require, New York you didn't, and then you moved to Alaska, wondering if you'd have to register here in that situation?
Through the chair, our interpretation of the language of the legislation says that if the offender has to register in the state where the offense occurred, then they'd have to register here.
Okay.
Senator McGuire, sorry, go ahead.
Thank you. And Kathy, I guess my question for you is, are the people that are calling, do you happen to know if they are considering moving to Alaska or if they're already here?
Through the chair, Senator McGuire, for the most part, they're considering moving here.
Right.
We also have individuals that come to the office once they are here that must be reviewed to determine if they have to register or not as well.
So if I might, just Mr. Chairman, on that point, the reason that I have been supportive of this provision, and I do understand the concerns that have been expressed in this committee and respect them. That said, I think what we're trying to do in our state is make this the very last place that you would want to consider moving if you are a sexual predator. And knowing how unlikely it is in terms of rehabilitation from the other presentations we've had over this last decade for people who are certain categories of sex offenders, I guess my concern is I'd like to make it as strict as possible. And if people are, if you will, forum shopping, and I understand that, you know, they don't want to register, they want their life to be different than it is, or they want another opportunity at a predator, whatever the reason is, I'd like to have that gate up that simply says, yes, you have to register. So.
Thank you, Senator McGuire. Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you. Yeah, absolutely. We don't want to. We certainly don't, as a state, want to facilitate forum shopping for sex offenders. The issue is starting to come back to me, Mr. Chairman, as we talk a little bit about it.
Right.
And remind me again if there were a case in Alaska where a person would have done something completely legal. Let's say. 18-year-old with a 16-year-old girlfriend, perfectly legal in Alaska, but they did it in another state, and maybe it's not legal. They had to register in that state. They would remind me, coming to Alaska, they would have to register for an offense which, had they committed in Alaska, would have been perfectly legal.
That's the rub. That's exactly the rub. And I guess I'm right now thinking we just should have Kathy Monfrey to tell them all, yes, you'll have to register, even if that's really not the answer. Just tell them.
Yeah.
And we'll immunize her from suit. And, all right, then we'll just.
All right.
and just, you know, just have her sort of be the gatekeeper.
Yes.
And the answer is, you know, we're going to cut off your thumb and we're going to make her register.
That's right.
So, sorry, a moment of levity is probably not a good idea on the record, but yeah. We just had one. In all seriousness, you know, Senator Wilkowski has illustrated, you know, the reason why it's something we've grappled with. You know, Ms. Monfreda's example of communicating with a minor for immoral purposes, that sounds like something that we have a statute close to. Maybe she has to say that it's not close enough, because if you look back on page 12, and I won't belabor the point, we'll move on because we've got more ground to cover. If you look back on page 12, lines 13 to 17 say a sex offense is a crime under our laws or a similar law of another jurisdiction. So we cover anything that's similar and say if you've committed a similar crime, you got to register. But if the crime isn't similar, then you don't have to register. And Ms. Monfreda has given us a good example of a crime that we would hope you'd have to register for, but Senator Wilkowski has illustrated that there are acts you can perform in another state that are perfectly legal if they're committed in Alaska. And we could potentially send you to jail you know, for not registering as a sex offender when the act you committed is not against our law. And so it's a conflict. And Senator McGuire, you know, has expressed what many of us think. You know, it's definitely not a black and white issue. So I'm so glad to have to grapple with it again. Thank you for bringing it to us. And so let's turn now to Quinlan Steiner, who may help us grapple with them even more. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Steiner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Quinlan Steiner. I'm the public defender for the state of Alaska. And I wanted to put on the record some of my concerns with this bill, one of which was already addressed by Ms. Carpinetti with regard to the C felony section of the patron statute. I do think there's a rewrite of the statute to make it absolutely clear. I think you could potentially prosecute a prostitute under Section 6 for a C felony, and I don't think that's the intent of the bill. My other concern relates to Section 16 with regard to video conferencing. That is the discussion revolving around the Confrontation Clause. This issue about whether or not the full confrontation right apply to a pretrial hearing has not squarely been addressed by the courts in Alaska. I think there's some federal courts that have permitted it, but our courts have made some pretty strong statements about confrontation. So that issue, I think, is up in the air. So you will certainly see a constitutional challenge with respect to this provision. And this certainly is a very different provision than the one that was provided for trial testimony. It's much broader. It really is very, there are no limitations in the sense that unavailability and the public interest and all that. So you'll definitely see a challenge.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, I was going to ask the law about how they would define unavailable. I'm just wondering if witness decided they wanted to go vacationing in Hawaii, and they said, well, I'm unavailable, but you can video conference me there. Is that something you think a court would allow, or do you think the language of this is broad enough to allow that?
In the trial section?
Yeah.
Theoretically, yes. I would hope the court would not do something like that. But unavailability has a limited definition. In one section, it refers to the rules of evidence and narrowly, but then it broadly just states unavailability. And I'm not sure if it's more specifically defined than that, other than on page 17, lines 22. You know, it says you're unavailable if, by clear and convincing evidence under the circumstances, the witness is unavailable. I'm not
right,
sure.
But just for a point of order, let's anyone who may be following this at home, Section 16 doesn't have an unavailability component.
No, Section 16 is uniquely of concern in that the court can order this without the limitations of a compelling interest. What this boils down to is if you have a competency hearing in a rural location, it can take time to travel there. And so it's often difficult to fly in and out in one day. And so there's often requests to have the experts, usually it's from API, testify telephonically. Sometimes that's agreed to, but it isn't always agreed to. And then they have to fly out and provide their testimony in person. And this is where the questions of confrontation are so important. You know, if a physician is saying this person is competent and somebody's contesting that finding, it makes cross-examination very difficult. and that's how you test the veracity and the reliability of that statement.
Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, I'm just imagining as an advocate, you want to show someone documents. How, I mean, talk about some of the difficulties that you would encounter in trying to cross-examine someone over video teleconference.
It would be very difficult. You'd have to have a set of documents in both locations that were exactly the same and numbered well enough that you could refer back to it. It would be virtually impossible to confront somebody with a document that they didn't already have. And some cross-examination is conducted that without prior presentation, refreshing recollections, inconsistent statements, that sort of thing. And so what you're getting at, that creates sort of a functional problem, which reduces the effectiveness of that technique of ensuring reliability. There's also this separate question about face-to-face confrontation and what that means. I mean, there's lots of case law, and specifically if you read Craig in the dissent, they talk about the nature of what persisting in testimony means as opposed, you know, outside of the presence of somebody as the difference when they're in their presence. It's much harder to persist in a statement that might not be supportable when you're somewhere else and you're not actually confronted by the persons involved. And this comes up in competency hearings where one of the questions is, you know, did the physician spend enough time with the patient to determine whether or not they were actually competent? And those are the principal questions that come up.
How many, not that we hinge constitutional rights on the volume, but how many competency hearings happen every year in Alaska, just roughly?
I don't know the answer to that question.
More than 20, less than 20?
Certainly more than 20.
More than 20.
Yeah,
okay.
It's a fairly common issue that's litigated.
Senator Wilkowski.
Are you often, since these are expert witnesses, I'm imagining there's a large volume of information. Are you often confronting them with large documents, books, for instance, and do you often present them with evidence that you haven't provided them before the hearing?
That is certainly a possibility, that you'd be presenting them with something that you weren't specifically giving them before. That most frequently comes up in inconsistent statements, if somebody makes an inconsistent statement. But for experts, usually there's often a large volume of notes and reports that have been written. Some folks will have a history that goes back a long way, so it can be a voluminous documentation of the history.
Senator Coghill.
What I understand is a competency hearing is the professional testimony regarding somebody's ability to be tried under certain circumstances. And so it really is the professional testimony at stake here, not necessarily the person in question themselves. Do I understand it correctly?
Yes, when the cross-examination of the testimony is, you know, is this person competent to stand trial or not?
So it's really the professional people that are going to be the ones putting testimony forward. So the response or not response of the individual in question probably isn't as big a deal as a professional testifier, is what I understand. Am I right?
I think, are you asking whether or not the client or the patient will testify at these hearings?
No. Mr. Chairman, once again, this is the non-lawyer asking. Trying to figure out the professional testimony is really as what is at stake here on credibility here. For what I think I understand is the person who is under question of competency is not going to be testifying on their behalf. So their responses before the court are probably less valuable than the professional testimony, and that's what I'm trying to figure out, if I understand that.
Yeah, the professional testimony is everything. Yeah. They're trying to make a determination about somebody's...
And, Mr. Chairman, my point is that with professionals who testify before a court, having paperwork in order, having been able to follow things, probably is, to me, less of a problem than if they were under light representation, which may be the case in Alaska, you know. So having a professional testimony probably is less critical in my eye.
Well, your question has caused me to wonder about the difference in having a jury evaluate evidence versus a judge. The
the difference here is that this hearing, this competency hearing, is a legal issue being decided by a judge, whereas the second section we'll get to in a minute is about testimony that's going to take place where the jury is the fact finder. So I don't know what legal analysis has been done with respect to the difference in confrontation rights before a judge versus before a jury, but I imagine there's some subtle differences.
And those are the differences I think the federal courts have used to draw a distinction between the confrontation that would apply pretrial and confrontation that applies at trial. I think that's they use those types of analysis to draw a distinction, and that these hearings aren't necessarily related to the substance of the crime, and I think they've used those as well.
Interesting.
That's why I can, you know, our court hasn't specifically said, you know, in these pretrial competency matters, confrontation applies. But they have made some pretty strong statements in prior cases about confrontation in other venues, parole, but it hasn't squarely been put in front of them that I know of.
Well, I'd just soon only pass one unconstitutional statute every couple of years. We just did one last year, so we're going to be a little cautious here. Senator Coghill and Senator Lukowski.
One other question for that, and then this obviously is a judge's discretionary use. Do they have a protocol that they would fall under this? Are there rules that they would already have in place for some clarity that may give us some guidance under this?
No, under this statute, they don't. They could look back to the trial procedures, but this one doesn't specifically provide them any more guidance than what's stated in here as there's a contemporaneous two-way video conference. Yeah. They certainly could look to the trial procedures too.
Okay. Thank you.
To shore it up if they chose, but it's not required.
Senator Wilkowski.
Just more of a comment and sort of in response to Senator Coghill, but I would think in this sort of hearing where you have experts involved, the exchange of documents it could be even more critical, and you probably have more of a high volume of documents with an expert. You're probably talking about treatises, you're probably talking about psychological DSM analysis, and it is a huge decision. The competency issue it could mean the difference between someone serving life in prison and not. So I think we need to tread very lightly in what we do here.
Good comments. Although I was just sitting here thinking about the rise in stature of the video conferencing technician who may be charged with having, an attorney goes to court, attorney has all the documents he or she intends to use in their, box. You may not use them. But you've got them with you. You don't just sort of run out of court and go, find a picture or an encyclopedia. And it may be that you, have to put a copy in the hands of the video conference technician and say, hey, confront the guy with this now or that now.
Yeah, I mean, there are instances where documents become relevant through the question
sure.
that you didn't anticipate to be
no,
relevant.
But you still got them with you. I mean, it's not as if, you're not going to take an Addies and run out. I mean, maybe it happens that you take an Addies and run down to the law library and come back with the DSM, but chances are you got it with you.
Best to be prepared, but
right.
having some way to pass that across. Mm-hmm.
Right, you would have had to transmit right. that copy, an extra copy of everything that you plan to use to right. somebody, whether it's someone else in your office or some neutral party that then can hand it to the witness.
So, Mr. Chairman,
tricky. Yeah, Senator Coghill.
Just once again, it's a new world to me. So, is this such a timely issue that only one hearing will be allotted to this particular issue?
Good question, Senator Mr. Steiner. How many are these? Frequently one hearing issues, or they take sometimes two or more hearings?
They can take a lot of time. It can go on for more than one day. If you're found incompetent initially, then you're brought back in for subsequent hearings if they restore you to competence. So the issue can span many different hearings for different purposes, but even the simple competency hearing can be more than a day, or more than what's allotted for a specific hearing.
Senator Wilkowski.
Do you occasionally, in these type of proceedings, deal with confidential documents that you'd now be placing in some third-party video conferencing operator's hands?
Medical analysis?
Yeah, I mean, all of this is theoretically confidential and not subject to disclosure.
Tricky. Let's turn now to the, that's one aspect. The other aspect is, was there more you wanted to address? I'm sorry.
No, and I'd be happy to switch over to the trial section. There's one other section I want to talk about.
Let's do the trial section while we're thinking about it. And we'll.
You know, this is the, all the concerns about confrontation are raised here.
We're in section 25.
And although I think this drafting does its best to comply with what Craig, the United States Supreme Court decision in Craig, requires, you know, it does open up this question as unavailability quite broadly, in the sense that it isn't narrowed. And I think Ms. Carpenter is right. You're going to look at unavailability on a case-by-case basis, but that doesn't necessarily mean you're going to get a finding that will pass constitutional muster. There's also the question in this about whether it's an important state interest. That should be a case-by-case analysis, but the way it's drafted opens up to sort of a broad single finding for these reasons. We're going to find that this type of fact pattern fits, and it could be broadened beyond case by case. But I think the case very clearly sort of indicates you really need to analyze this on a case by case basis. And I think there's two sections, two potential fixes you could do to assist in just this overall use of trial testimony if this becomes law. One is to make sure that this is litigated pretrial with an evidentiary hearing. This really needs to not happen right at trial, right at the beginning of trial, because this is a very complex issue about whether or not the video conferencing is sufficient and whether or not the factual circumstances justify these decisions. And the other recommendation I would make is a requirement that the video be secured, recorded, and preserved as part of the record, because the challenges that you will see will relate to your ability to confront. And so without that record, it'd be very difficult to determine whether or not what was done in any particular case actually complied with the confrontation clause.
Do you see any it's probably impossible to capture in the bill, which is why they didn't do it, but do you see any distinction between a witness, for example, like a victim, you know, sort of a central witness versus the more peripheral one, you know, the cop that transported the guy to, you know, the jail, or a person who's simply in the chain of custody who's completing that chain to prosecute a drug case?
You could certainly draw distinctions, but sometimes those seemingly collateral facts become the key to whether or not either side's theory of the case is actually physically even possible. Sometimes those small facts from what appear to be unimportant witnesses are where the case is turned. Certainly with cases where there's a victim and a young one, like in the Craig case, they made a case for a compelling interest in terms of preserving the mental state of this young person. I think it's important when you're balancing this to look at what Justice Scalia says in his dissent about the nature of what happens when a charge is leveled. People are put in jail, witnesses and children of the people who are being charged, they don't see them again. And what he points out is the first time that that child may see the person they're accusing is at the trial. And if they had made a false statement, it's much easier to persist in that false statement when they're not actually confronted by their parent. And those are important considerations when balancing these interests.
Justice Scalia can be a devastating writer, and I look forward to reading the case. You probably have another minute to give us other comments, and then we'll move on.
I wanted to skip back to Section 20 about the requirement of making it requiring registration if you have a conviction in another state that requires you to register. There is that problem that was discussed that you may actually be having engaged in conduct that's just not criminal here. But this is not something you can control. The states can change their registration offenses at any time, and it would be constantly changing what was required here in the sense of what your prior conduct was. And I did a little bit of research and found a report from the National Juvenile Justice Network written in 2007, which gave some list of some crimes that were registration offenses in other states. Public urination in 13 states is a registration offense, and only two of those states limit that conduct to being in the presence of a minor. Consensual sex between minors, 29 states, 32 states, indecent exposure, only seven of which limit that to in the presence of minors, and adult prostitution-related offenses in five states. So you have strictly legal conduct, but you also have things that may potentially be illegal here, but I'm not sure that there's something you'd want or intend to have registration offenses. So those problems will remain throughout the life of that section of the statute. I don't know how you would address it, but that is a concern.
I think in a perfect world, the Department of Law would figure out where its sort of rub is, what sorts of crimes that are being committed in other states are so problematic for us that they cause us a public safety concern, but we don't capture with a statute and pass a statute. And that way, boom, you're done, because we've enacted a similar law, and we've decided as a society that we're, you know, against this, and we're going to make you register for it. That's the cleanest way, and I don't know how Herculean of a task that is, but they are Herculean people over there at the Department of Law. They are strong-shouldered individuals. We have come to the end of the day. It's 3:03. I know committee members have other places to be. I appreciate everyone's attendance today, and to the witnesses we did not get to, we'll give you plenty of notice about when to come back. Thanks so much for being here. With that, we are adjourned.